Sleep, and it doesn't mean going to sleep. people waking up and these being asleep. You know what the purpose of that is. And so the only way that that can make sense is if you are mindful of the purpose of sleep afterwards. Sometimes the use of the past and present is quite loose in private. They have something called our historic present. Now there I am, just having lunch today. I'm not having lunch. I have lunch, but we have this historic present, remembering something and putting it into the present moment. So, please, when the one page of that, when I come to that tomorrow and on the next day, I will emphasize that and point it out now. But it is, these are restraining the five hindrances. That's why we have the sense restraint. We have the, as part of the higher practice of virtue, in order that we can actually see things more clearly. The five hindrances are stated to be that thing which weakens wisdom, which hinders stillness. So hopefully, that's an important point. Thank you for paying attention. But it does mean those five hindrances aren't totally eradicated, but they're weakened enormously, enough so that you can practice mindfulness and not be have your wisdom distorted. What is the Buddhist view on death in the following circumstances? Assisted suicide, as in Switzerland, keeping people alive when they are and have been for some time unable to swallow food or drink by using chew feeding, and treating a pneumonia with an antibiotic in an elderly person with end-stage dementia. You've probably heard me say in other talks that the purpose of a carer, a doctor, a psychologist, psychiatrist, whatever, anyone in those type of professions, is not to cure, but to care. And if we take curing, keeping people alive, as the main purpose, we get into some very, very intrusive and uncomfortable sort of end-of-life situations. I got this from a Tibetan man, and I did this little exercise myself when I was in Hong Kong. I had like a workshop situation, and I divided the people, who were mostly like nurses, counselors, a couple of doctors as well, into two groups. And I just pair off A and B. And then the exercise was that when I ran the gong, those who were assigned A2 would act out as best they possibly could, having a heart attack, medical attack, falling to the floor. And you know, when I was just talking to each other, I rang the gong, it wasn't really the gong. And then, and they fall onto the floor. Because they were in that profession, they think they were having heart attacks before. So they knew what they were acting out. And the other one was supposed to be the first responder. And so it went something like, some people won't really know what to do. Others were sort of saying, keep looking at me. Keep your eyes open. Be with me. Keep with me. Help is coming. It's going to be okay. And then we had feedback afterwards. It was only play acting. For the person who was enduring the heart attack, playing, role playing, how did it feel? And he said it was so intrusive. It was so unacceptable. Dying is a very private moment. And all these people trying to keep you alive at all costs, when you just want some space to die. And that was only sort of summary. Then we reversed the roles. And then when I rang the bell, and the other person then had a heart attack, then the first responder was more saying, oh, it's okay, just let go, be peaceful, remember your good karma. Keeping them alive was not a priority anymore. Instead, in the plants and peace, some stillness, some happiness, some joy, however that was, that became more important. And what it did, it gave this person, in a hospital in Hong Kong. What they did, it just emphasizes that we have a priority now in our culture, keeping people alive at all costs, being afraid of death. Because one of those reasons is because we think this is the only life we have. And so we've got to make it as long as possible, we've only got one chance. But you've got another life afterwards, another life, another life. Oh, it's not so important. As one of the great philosophers in Liverpool used to say, this was not John Lennon, this was Bill Shankly, who was the manager of Liverpool Football Club, who when asked why is it that some people think that football, soccer, is a matter of life and death, and he said, no, they're wrong. Soccer is not a matter of life and death, it's much more important than that. many people, if they follow soccer and sport, sometimes that's how they behave. Much more important than life and death. But because we are trying to keep people alive at all costs, we are cognizant. Now, with what we're talking about, assisted suicide, it's better described as euthanasia or voluntary euthanasia. Euthanasia is where you take people's decisions away from them and you euthanize them, basically to put them out of your misery, not of their misery. And you can understand why, to see somebody you love suffering so much, to see them such a shadow of their former selves, no quality of life, not really being able to know what's going on. And sure, the one who is suffering seeing them like that. So many times it's putting them out of your own suffering. But voluntary euthanasia, and basically that's not your right, to kill somebody else. And that's why we have those precepts in Buddhism. But more interesting is voluntary euthanasia, where the person makes their own decision to actually to commit suicide. And they make a rational decision when they're still able to make that decision. Most importantly, they have control of their senses and they are not under any coercion, from family or from others. And as best you possibly can, and there's always some problems, but you go through a couple of psychiatrists or something, first of all, a couple of doctors to make sure that, the illness is terminal. There's no real reasonable possibility of reversal of that decline into death. And also that you're in full control of your faculties. You're not depressed. You're not sort of angry. You're not making a statement. You are as clear as possibly can be. And you make that decision. And what happens is the person makes that, they've checked so many times. And we had one of the founders of Exit International come to a Buddhist conference in Perth some years ago because I wanted to find out exactly what it is. Before you make a decision, you know what you're deciding about. Because the first person in modern times who took voluntary euthanasia legally was a Mr. Dent in the Northern Territory who was a Buddhist. Because he was a Buddhist, I never met him, but one of my monks did, who him, why are you doing that? And the reason why he was doing that was what he said was to free his wife. His wife was giving him 24/7 care. She did get respite every now and again when she got exhausted. But nevertheless, she was of the understanding that no one else could convince her. It was her duty to look after the love of her life to the very end. He said he could endure the pain, discomfort of the last years of his life, but he couldn't stand seeing her sacrifice everything for him. He wanted to free her so she could have a life. And that was the purpose, the reason why he took part in euthanasia. And a drip was put into his arm. And he was on a computer screen. And there were many hurdles he had to cross. It wasn't just a casual decision, yes or no. And then the, I think it was using Mbutov, entered into the drip, into the stream, and then he went down really very peacefully, apparently. But he had many times he had to, do you know what's going to happen if you continue on? If you press this to continue, press this to stop. Many hurdles to make absolutely sure he knew what he was doing, what the consequence was. So, do I agree with that or not? It's not my business. It's your business. You are the owners of your karma, as they say in Buddhism. We take responsibility for our actions. And it's not up to me to say yes or no. But I certainly cannot criticize it. In cases where, especially with dementia, severe dementia, when I went and visited my mother, who's passed away, in a closed ward in St. Albans. My mother was always a positive woman, so she was quite peaceful with the dementia. But I sat next to two women who were continually terrified because they were waking up every couple of seconds. I have no memory of where they were, who they were, who was with them. And I could just about get some idea of how they felt, because I do travel around a lot, in hotels, and teaching, in monasteries, in retreat centers like this. And everywhere the first time you wake up in the morning, where the hell am I? What is this? Who am I with? And I've had that feeling when you first wake up. It takes you all year now in the retreat center. But imagine that happening every 2 or 3 seconds, 24 hours of your life, forever. They're in constant terror because they have no reference point, which we have in our past. No way to know where they were, who they were, what they're supposed to be doing. And it's so easy to see, you can't miss it, the terror in their faces. Not a physical pain, but the emotional suffering. So cases like that, all the time people make surveys, it's usually 70-80% of people saying, we want the option of voluntary euthanasia. It was stopped in Northern Territories because there was a couple of very staunch Christian politicians who stopped it. But now it's been permitted in Victoria, in Australia, and Western Australia, the state where I live, they're going to be voting on that next year, and everyone knows it's going to pass. I don't think voluntary euthanasia is permitted yet in UK, is that the case? Yeah. So, it's going to happen. What do you think? When it comes to Buddhism and your precepts, if you look very carefully, and I had this argument with Venerable Dharmavihari, who was a very interesting man. He was a scholar of Pali, and then he became a monk. And because he was English speaking, he had wonderful arguments. One of those arguments, you cannot argue with a monk. Just because you're a monk doesn't mean you're right. So you chat to each other, right? You're not right. In the end, I convinced him that the first precept, Paramati Paramayamani, is destroying the life of another. Suicide is on and it's fascinating why the Buddha would do that. And anyway, just to throw out a curly one for you. Did the Buddha commit suicide? Our Buddha. Because they can't do that. No, he can't commit suicide. According to the story, that he ate a pork curry at the very end of his life. Surely he would have known with his powers that that was going to kill him. He did that willingly. And anyway, 3 months before he passed away, he told people I'm going to die in 3 months. He willingly let go of his life. Isn't that a definition of suicide? Willingly creating the situation and causes where your life ends. Ananda, his close attendant, he was being chased by two kings or leaders of areas because they both wanted his ashes. Ashes and relics are big business. If you don't believe me, just if you have time, go look at the cathedral in Norwich. The cathedral is one of the reasons why Norwich became a big city. I think remember it's St. Julian of Norwich or something. But anyway, there was this little priest from Norwich who had this small little country town. He went on pilgrimage about 6 or 7 centuries ago into Europe, where one of these saints in a cathedral, they would display his body in an open casket once a year, so that the pilgrims could kiss his deceased body for good luck, either with diseases, illnesses, or business or whatever. So it was a gross thing to do. I'm not sure if I would ever just kiss a body who's been dead for 50 years. But that's what people do to go back. And so this priest from Norwich, he travelled all the way to some place in Europe, I forget where. But he did much more than kiss. He bit off this saint's nose. Kept it in his mouth, because that's the only way he could smuggle it through the equivalent of customs. And he brought it all the way back here to Norwich. So that Norwich had a part of his saint's body, his nose. And they put it on display. And so many pilgrims came from all over England and many other places, which meant they needed hotels, food, looking after their horses. And that was the start of Norwich becoming economically viable. If you have time, check that out in the cathedral up in Norwich. So Ananda is similar, that people love relics. I know it's stupid, but for those of you who wonder about Buddhism, the Buddha said, don't be an heir to my material things, be an heir to my Dhamma, my teachings. So the relics of the Buddha, please excuse me if you get upset, the relics of the Buddha are his teachings, not Dhammas. But anyway, even Ananda, he was getting out about to die, and two people wanted his relics. Two countries, principalities in India. So he got to the boundary river between the two principalities, and then he used his psychic powers, rose up into the air, immolated himself, and then two exactly equal piles of ashes fell on either side of the river, so those two countries wouldn't go to war. Interesting. If any of you know ancient Greek, please have a look. Somewhere in, I forget which text it was now, Greek text, in Athens, in the Forum in Athens, there was an Indian person called Samana Chagas. That's the translation which I saw. Samana means a monk, who was in Athens, and he created a big scene, a furor, in the Forum when he self-immolated. It's only a sentence which I read, but my goodness, hey, that's what happened in India. And you know, just killing himself, committing suicide, that was nothing, but to enter the fire element and burn himself. And that would have been something which would have been recorded somewhere and was there. So interesting, anyway. But that's, isn't that not welcome to euthanasia? I'm not answering that question because some questions need to be considered by you. Anyway, affirm the power of metta. I use your spoken method on the doorstop near the canteen. It wouldn't stay down, but after a stroke it worked fine. There's some strange things which you've seen in your life. Think anything's to work. Getting cars to work as well. Car won't start. Give us some loving kindness. You wouldn't believe how many times it starts after that. It's wonderful that you and Daniel Chandler are here in England to help set up the Anakamba Bikini Project. Is it really true that Daniel Chandler is the only Bikini in the UK, the only English Bikini currently in the UK? Is English Bikinis over in, how long do we have in California?
There's a Welsh Bikini.
Welsh.
And there is an English Bikini who used to be there.
Okay, yeah.
And that's it.
Okay. Yeah. So, it's true. This is shocking. Please can say a bit more about this. Thank you. So, they're not there. There's lots of women who are attempting to become Theravada bhikkhunis, but the bhikkhuni ordination was not allowed for them, so they went overseas instead. But I was personally responsible for some of that fuel 9 years ago, because I decided to give bhikkhuni ordination to 4 bhikkhunis who were over in Perth at the time. They asked, "Can we ordain?" So, well, why not? So I organised a bhikkhuni ordination for them to start it off, but they weren't allowed to do that here in the UK, so many of them just left. But the bhikkhunis, fully ordained Buddhist monks. But this is personal, I keep on repeating this, but it's one of the reasons why I get involved even now, was that somebody came up to me, I forget who they were, maybe a year or 2 years afterwards, and I think this was in the London Buddhist Society in Eccleston Square, and they said, "England is dark for women who want to become fully ordained nuns." said something like that. And of course, that really hit me hard. Sometimes people say things very short, but with such pain, you think, I can't permit that to continue. One of the other things which somebody said to me, and this was even longer ago, this was in Perth, Australia. I'd given a talk, on religious harmony and stuff. And this gentleman came up, he announced himself to me, he was maybe in his 60s. He said, I'm one of the leaders of the gay community here in Perth. Religion has been so cruel to our community. And then he walked away. And that word is cruel. Why? But instead of just saying, well, it's terrible, it's awful, and just walking away myself, I said, let's do something about this. So, whatever opportunity you have, you take that opportunity to address some of the people in our world who are really, really giving a hard time. For no reason whatsoever. Well, no reasonable reason. That's the reason, isn't it? So anyway, so with the beginnings, that's why I don't have to do this. Come to England and teach all the time. I'm getting old, I should be retiring, but it's unfinished business. So I'll make it happen. But of course, I need your assistance. So this is not just Ajahn Brahm retreat. Please check in with Venerable Chandra. See how you can help. Because I think we need monastery. We have one in Perth, don't we? Why not here? Look at us coming. Sometimes I find myself thinking unwholesome thoughts about people who are difficult. Wise, seemingly unkind. Rude, seemingly unkind. How does one deal with this? People are difficult, rude, unkind. There's a reason for them being unkind. They're in a bad mood today. Something's happened to them. A lot of time it's not to do with you. They just, as they say, woke up on the wrong side of the bed this morning. And everybody, they'll kick the cat, they won't feed the dog, they'll shout at people. And what really, I thought, was a very cool reflection was something the Dalai Lama once said. He said, you know, that those people, difficult, rude, unkind, you may have to work with them. You know, when you go to your job, you meet them on the bus or the tube. You only have to meet them for a few hours every day, if that. And they have to live with themselves 24 hours a day for the rest of their life. Because if they're unkind to you, imagine their relationship to themselves. You get such compassion for them. Poor thing, if you're not unkind to me, must be a terrible to do with yourself. So you don't even think of yourself anymore because their pain and suffering is much more intense than any unkindness which they give to you. So turn the unwholesome thoughts into compassionate thoughts. Fortunately, life is like that. It's good people put in intolerable situations. Not bad people. Just bad people put into impossible positions. One of the jobs is to see if we can take away stress and expectations so that people aren't put in impossible situations. Sometimes it's the situation which makes the anger in the person. It's not them. Anyway, next one. In the mindfulness of the body section of the Mahasatipatthana Sutta's English translation, the following is there. Again, the monk when walking knows that he is walking, when standing knows that he is standing, when sitting knows that he is sitting, when lying down knows he is lying down. In whatever way his body is disposed, he knows that is how it is. But some teachers seem to be aware of the sensations when walking. sitting there central, being aware of the sensations twice a year, something different to knowing that one is walking. Sitting, etc. In other words, I believe it is possible just to know in your mind that you are walking, sitting, etc., without focusing on sensations to a minute level, as we're instructed to walking meditation. I wonder whether we are missing the point made by the Lord Buddha and overcomplicating the practice of mindfulness of the four postures. Bandit's comments would be much appreciated. Sometimes this is put under the heading of Sampajanya, which is not just being mindful, but being aware of why you are walking, what's the purpose of it. So, in the traditional Thai Buddhism, especially the forest tradition, you wouldn't just be mindful, just aware, you know the purpose of it. Why? And the example is, it's a bit cheeky, but it has a point to it. Once there was a very wealthy woman, and she was going to the temple one evening to listen to a nice Dhamma talk. And she'd known from the police reports that there was a series of burglaries in that area, targeting rich people's houses. So because she was wealthy, she had a gatekeeper, a guard, on the house. So before she'd have to go to the Dhamma talk, she told her gatekeeper, "Be mindful, there are thieves around." And the gatekeeper said, "Look, I practice meditation too, I practice vipassana, I will be mindful, don't worry about that, go and enjoy my Dhamma talk." So off she went to the Dhamma talk. When she came back, the burglars had rampaged right throughout her house, taken anything. So she asked the guard to the house, "Look, I thought I asked you to be mindful." "I was mindful, madam." "Well, how come we've been robbed?" "I was mindful. I saw the thieves going in, and I noticed thieves going in, thieves going in, thieves going in. I saw them taking all your jewelry out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I saw them backing up their lorry, backing up the lorry, backing up the lorry, backing up the lorry. I saw them putting the safe on the back of that lorry. Safe going out, safe going out. I was really mindful of everything, man." That is not enough, just being aware of walking, of sitting and lying down. Why are you doing that? What's the purpose of it? It's the mindfulness along with wisdom. Otherwise you'll end up just like that gatekeeper, getting the sacrifice. Please could you write down which rooms we could use for what? Thank you. You can use the bathroom. The letting go. The restaurant. The breakfast. The lunch. I think that's it.
There is a sign on the rooms. It's quite easy to find the rooms.
Okay. Yes. Where it says private, you can use that for privacy. When you see staff only, that's when you can get a stick, a staff, to be able to walk meditation without falling over. Okay. Does one have to have done certain right or correct things in previous lives in order to have any chance of achieving enlightenment in this one? And is it fact that I'm here and interested in seeing the evidence that I did? Well, give yourself the benefit of the doubt. You're here. Human being is supposed to be a very, very, very good birth, being a human being. Sometimes it must have been pre-recorded in England. That may be started to do wrong in the previous life. But not that much. Sorry, I'm being cheeky. But the point is, we don't know what we've done in our previous life unless you do get a deep meditation, get some past lives coming up. But give yourself the benefit of the doubt, you don't know. So how far you can go. So give it a try. With walking meditation, I was very aware of my feet legs. I started to notice that the floor had disappeared. Ooh. And some of the visions switched off. When noticing the floor reappearing, I then noticed my feet had vanished. Both floor and feet were absent, and I was aware of the sound of the heating in the room. This fact continued. Any comments?
Yeah, fine. Weird stuff. If it's weird stuff, unusual stuff, don't be scared. This is great. It gives you something to actually to contemplate, because otherwise you've got another how many more days to go. It'll be really boring.
Just walking and sitting, sitting down, hearing my young bomb, saying the same old jokes, I've heard those on YouTube before. Maybe it's suited, but it's all part of mindfulness.
Say something weird happens, that's great.
So, this, don't think about it, explore it. Why does this happen? What does it feel like? Are you afraid? What's going on? Where do thoughts arise from? What causes it? It is discontent. They arise from within you, they don't come from outside. If they were coming outside, we could maybe put some barrier up, some psychic defences, some a wall with not just bricks, but thick lead, which no electromagnetic radiation or what else, any gamma rays can penetrate. But they still come because they come from inside of you. You create them to give yourself something to think about. It's a distraction. But when you're very peaceful, content, happy, it's hardly any thoughts. The other time, I mentioned already when I just had all these questions and thoughts with this great monk, Ajahn Tate. And just as soon as I go into his presence, everything vanished and so still. Not just a question, no questions in my mind, but no thoughts in my mind. Because I was so accepted. I didn't have to prove anything. When you really feel, sometimes you can talk about it as total acceptance, love, compassion. You don't need to think anymore. You don't have any business to do. And thought is the language of business. When you're just here, nothing to think about, you don't want to think. It's just too peaceful, too joyful. How many of you like great classical music? I remember just going to concerts. And I never realised at the time, one of the delightful features of great music is that you're not allowed to speak. If I was listening to some, it's about Monty Verdi. And hello, I just really loved that before I became a monk. And then if you went to a concert and said, wow, that was really good, wasn't it? In the middle of the concert, you'd be thrown out, disturbing the flow of the course, and your appreciation of them. So I never realised at the time the great music, you were right there in every moment. There was present moment awareness. There was no thinking, because your mind was totally satisfied with the beautiful orchestral and choral music. You don't have to think. When you enjoy it, Were you satisfied and content? So of course, when you really, really get into the joyful meditations, the thoughts can't come at all. They can't even break through. So the causes of this discontent. Talking about real big contentment now. And also feeling no acceptance. You don't need to prove anything or do anything. Even people coming here, they're trying to achieve jhanas, trying to get enlightenment, trying to get wisdom, doing stuff. Oh, okay, you get enlightenment, then what? What happens next? Why is it always the next? I mentioned earlier, you pass one exam, you have another one coming next year, or next week sometimes. Why not fail now? Be a loser. So you've got nothing to attain for the rest of the retreat. Not aiming for anything. You know, sometimes I do that as a bit of a trick. Usually on the last day, I look at someone and say, look, none of you have got anywhere near jhanas yet. You're the most hopeless crowd of meditators I've ever had the misfortune to teach. You're hopeless, you can't do it, so just relax. Then people get some good meditation. They're not trying. They're not desperately struggling to prove something to themselves or to others. You know, I'm talking about that tightness of tension. I've got to say something to my friend. I've just paid a lot of money, spent 8 days, and I've got nothing to show for it. Don't get so quick. That tightness of tension is the problem. Anyway. Dear Ajahn Brahm, some teachers say not to use the breath all the time as the object of the meditation, as you will become attached to the breath. I'm attached to the breath ever since I was born. If I let the breath go, I'm dead. It would be difficult to lose other types of meditation, like watching body sensations. Would Ajahn advise to change the object for the meditation of the breath to washing the body sensation from time to time? Or is it better to stick, e.g., with the breath of one is used to doing the breath meditation practice jhanas? Look, it's just the breath comes and goes by itself. Just when you are eating, you're not aware of the breath. When you're driving a car, you're not aware of the breath going in, breath going out, crash. If a nice answer to this is something which I think I said on the first night, I certainly said in many other places, the Emperor's Three Questions meditation. Now is the most important time. The Emperor's Three Questions was the person in front of you is the most important person in the world. The meditation, the object in front of you right now, whatever it is, is the most important thing in the whole world. That's what you're aware of. Whatever's here right now. And the only thing to do, the most important thing to do, is to care. Care for the subject. Don't try and cure it like that doctor said that. Care for it. It has, whatever it is, it's forgotten torpor, restlessness, some weird fantasy, it's here to teach you something. Give it respect. Has that ever happened to you? That people just don't respect you? You've got something to tell them and they just push you away. There was this doctor over in Sydney. And you know, he made a lot of money, he bought himself a new sports car. And how can you enjoy a sports car in the city? This is too many and police, too much traffic. So he drove out into the sticks
into the countryside, and he put his foot down. Whoa! And he enjoyed just the power and the speed. Whoa! And as he was just really so selfishly making a lot of noise, speeding down these country lanes, he saw a farmer just, you know, by the side of the road, shouting out, "Pig!" And he turned around and said, "Who are you calling a pig?" And he crashed into a pig and rode his sports car, and the pig as well. Not very good. The farmer was trying to warn him, "Pig!" So when we're not really mindful, and we interpret things in the wrong way, we not only make a bad karma of killing an animal, but also we destroy our sports car. So, the thing right in front of you is the most important thing in the world to watch. It's not always the best. And even in a meditation here, there comes a time when breath changes. And soon it gets into a delightful breath, which I will describe tomorrow in the Satipatthana. And from there into this beautiful minute, the breath is gone. It just transcends into something else. You don't get attached to the breath. The breath transforms you, but inside of it to something more beautiful. So, body sensations? The body sensations are there again to be transcended. Another simile for you, this was actually from the Samajapada Sutta, when King Ajatasattu went to see the Buddha for the first time. And he went in his chariot, in his vehicle, as far as he could. And when he got to the gates of the monastery, he got out of the jetwan, at least the Bambuka monastery, he got out of his chariot and walked in his shoes. And through the monastery grounds to the hall. And then he got out of his shoes to enter the hall and see the Buddha standing against the pillar. Different things at different times. You can't drive the chariot into the Dhamma hall. And you can't use the shoes, you know, through the muddy, stony paths, you know, to the monastery. Just like I came from Australia in a jet. An aircraft. But they wouldn't allow me to park the aircraft in the car park of Belsay Bridge Retreat Centre. I had to get out of the aircraft and get into a car. From a car, it's actually attached to a train. Train first of all. And from the train the train wouldn't stop at Belsay Bridge. There's no station here, let alone train tracks. And then there a taxi, but the taxi would not come into the hall. I had to get out of the taxi, then walk in shoes, and then from shoes, barefoot into the hall. Different vehicles for different times. So even a breath, you can only use it for a certain time, and then you get into something much more refined to take you deeper into meditation. That's how it works. I'll explain that tomorrow because it comes up in the world. Thank you, you are simply the best loser. They say the biggest loser, isn't it? That's the word, but anyway, best loser, I'll take that. I have a saying that being a monk, you should be humble. And if you're humble, what's the point of being humble if you can't flaunt it? All that hard work of 44 years being a monk, I'm so humble, I can't hide it. Some people don't know about it. So if you're humble, flaunt it. Imagine from I've been experimenting with allowing, giving permission in my mind to wander through my meditation object. This sport to mind your story of the mother allowing the child to leave home. My mind seems to naturally come home to the object with a greater sense of stability. Have I got the simile correct? Is this a good strategy? Yeah.
sometimes it's not a strategy because you're developing kindness. Another simile for you to understand this. Okay. You've got a free afternoon, maybe a public holiday somewhere, and you know somebody calls you on your cell phone, and it's a friend, not a close friend, but a friend, and said, "Do you want to come out for a cup of coffee this afternoon?" He said, "Okay." And they said, "Great, because I want to take you to this coffee shop. I know you don't like this type of coffee, but I want you to try it. And I want you to actually come and discuss politics with me, because I know you're always talking about Buddhism and meditation, but this is really important, politics, you know, how this world is going to sort of develop. And I want to sit in the back, I know you like sitting in the front of coffee shops, and you're not going to sort of have a biscuit. We're going to have a chocolate chip muffin. I don't really think it's bad for your health, but I'm having a chocolate chip muffin, you're going to have a chocolate chip muffin. We're going to sit there for an hour. That's all the time I've got." If somebody invited you out for a cup of coffee, what they want, not really concerned what you wanted, to actually to discuss what you want, what they want to talk about, not what you want, to eat what they want, not what you want, sit what they want, not what you want, sit for the time they want to sit, not what you want to sit. What would you do? You try very quickly to make up an excuse. "Oh, yeah, I've got to go and see the dentist this afternoon. I'm terribly sorry, maybe some other time." Because no one likes to be with a control freak telling you what to do, how to do it. So as soon as you're off the phone, to keep your precepts and keep your sincerity, your virtue, you quickly ring up the dentist and make an appointment in the afternoon. And as soon as you've made the appointment and get off the line, another phone call comes from another friend of yours. Say, "How are you free this afternoon?" "I just made an appointment for the dentist." "That's a shame, because I know you have this coffee shop. You're always telling me about really good, healthy coffee. And is it a chocolate?" "No, the free range biscuits." I mean, fair trade or something. "I just really, really delicious. And you always tell me about this meditation and Buddhism, and just, I've never actually had the chance to really discuss it with you. Can you talk about it? I know you like sitting out in front. I like being in the back, but I'll say what you want to say." And if they want to talk about what you want to talk about, eat and drink what you like, sit where you like, "Okay, I'll be there." And you get on the phone, "Sorry, dentist, but I've got other appointments." And then you go and sit with them. And you're supposed to only have an hour. You spend 3 or 4 hours sitting there with someone who's kind and interested. Now the meaning of that simile is, sometimes you tell your mind, "Okay, we're going to go to the hall. I know you like sitting elsewhere in these other rooms. You're going to sit in the hall. You are going to watch the breath. I know you're not watching other objects, but today you're going to watch what I want you to watch, the breath. And you're going to do it for 1 hour, not 2 hours or half an hour. You're going to sit there for 1 hour because that's what I want you to do. You're not going to sit in the back, you're going to sit in the front. That's where I'm sitting." And sometimes that's what you do to your mind. "Okay, right, this is it. We're going to do an hour's meditation, okay? An hour, mind. You hear that? An hour. You're not going to wander off anywhere. Maybe you're not wandering off here, wandering off there, contemplating all sorts of stuff. You are going to watch the breath. The breath. Got it?" And what does your mind do? It makes another appointment somewhere. Anywhere to get away from you. I think you get the message. Your mind wanders off to get away from you, to escape from you, from the control freak, telling your present mind what to do and how to do it. That is not the way to meditate. That is why the mind wanders. But my mind used to wander off. Instead of suppressing it, he's enforced it. Why? Why can't we just sit together and watch the breath? Right? And soon exploited this because my mind was afraid of me. It had traumatized by me. Sometimes I would sit there and have them charge my mind. You've got to watch the breath, okay? Watch it. I'm traumatized by the force which I used on my mind. So my mind never trusted me. So whatever that question, you're beginning to establish trust with your mind and you. In other words, you can hang out together. Why just wander off when you're with a good friend? So he's doing well. You always seem so comfortable with yourself. Do you ever get anxious or scared? Oh, I knew you were going to ask that question. Anxious or scared? There was one time when there was about 5-6 years of a monk in Thailand, and there was a series of buses exploded in flames. They were very, very poorly maintained. And even a fellow monk of mine, you know, he was in a bus and it's caught on fire. He had to rush out and he lost his bowl and roll. And actually the bus company just sent him a replacement bowl and roll. It was occurring again, again, again. And I was in the bus, just sitting. They always put the monks up the front. And I was in the window, not the window seat, the aisle seat. And another monk was actually in the window seat. And then I hadn't read those reports in the newspapers. So when a gentleman sort of from the back shouted out, "Fire, fire!" The bus driver slammed on the brakes. The bus driver went through, he just climbed out the window, as did the monk sitting next to me. He climbed out the window too. And there were so many people just crowding the aisle trying to get out. And as one of the very strict rules you keep as a monk in Thailand is not to come into physical contact with a woman. And so there's lots of girls there, so I was just waiting for them all to go out before I could go out. I never realised it was an emergency. And any moment that sort of bus would explode into flame. So I was just sitting there, peaceful. All the others had gone out. I was about to get out of my seat and get out myself. And there was one gentleman in the back who was actually investigating. So I was only a cigarette. We put it out. It's not a real fire. The man sitting next to me was very embarrassed because he just went out the window. And because I was in the window, not on the aisle seat at the front, everybody coming back into the bus, they had to pass me. It wasn't that I was an arahat, that I was stupid, I didn't know what was going on. But that's okay, anyway. So, why are you being scared or anxious? As far as the people is concerned, they're anxious. Why are you anxious? Whatever happens, happens. I had this, sometimes when I first really became popular as a speaker, it was weird. Because the one time I got invited to give this, my first really big talk, I think it was about 4,000, 5,000 people in Singapore, in a convention centre, just me. No one else. And as I went into the halls of all these people, it was like a rock concert. And I saw the chair where I was going to sort of deliver the talk. I thought, what the hell's going on? How did I get myself into this? That's my feeling. And I thought, this is dangerous stuff. Really, really scary territory in the sense that I see many, many people
when they get such fame, fortune, adulation, they lose it. Then I thought, hang on, no, it's not me. It's all the teachings which I got. Was no from Ajahn Chah, the other teachers I knew. I've just been a vehicle for them. You have the idea of oneself. As soon as I got that perception, it's nothing to do with me. I don't know my teachings. Therefore, I'm not afraid of them. So I can sit there and have fun with no anxiety, not worrying if people thought it was good. Because that was good, what a wonderful thing to be able to share with them. And if I really stuffed up and made a mess of it, that was an even better outcome. And I could go back to Australia and stay in my cave and have a nice peaceful life. Either way, I would. That type of positive attitude means that I didn't invest any sort of energy or hopes or fears in being a success. Either way, didn't matter. That means that I didn't feel. How can I stop being scared of Christ? Go and find one. If you find one, just, if you can find, there's this time of year in England, and in the other countries too, there is a ghost, a lot of ghosts that always come out this time of year. And it's one of the most dangerous ghosts in the world. And I personally seen it possess people. It can happen to one of my just bring people to you. And I've seen it even kill people. And we call it, in Thailand, it's called Pinakua, which translates as the ghost in the bottle. It's called whiskey. Fear. You drink a few sips of that and it possesses you. You know they're possessed because they don't talk in a normal voice. They can't walk in a straight line. They're possessed. And sometimes they drive a car and kill themselves. Now that's why whiskey and gin and vodka, that's why it's called spirits. The ghost in the bottle. Those ghosts I have seen. And those are dangerous spirits. Other ghosts are they just little cute, poor people just being stuck somewhere. So why are you scared of them? I think it's probably too many movies, too many books. People love to scare themselves. And then, you know, when that scariness sticks, they get stuck like that. When I told the story of ghosts in the last retreat I gave in Jhanagru, there's the most unlucky person is this guy, very strong. He went back to his room. He lay down. He had the shutter on the window shut. And then as soon as he lay down, he heard something walking towards his window. He was fully awake, but imagining it, heard it walking, stopped at his window. And he was two minds, should I just hide under the blankets, or should I open the window? He tried to open the window, and he looked out, and he saw it, and the thing saw him. It was a kangaroo! And the kangaroo said, "Ah!" The kangaroo ran away. The kangaroo is the one which is scared. And this actually happens so often in Australia because the kangaroos are nighttime. They don't hop. They just put their feet out and they just move forward. They drag their back feet forward. And telling people it sounds like somebody walking. So most goats just do not exist. The other ones do exist. That's just a fun. So I have to be scared of ghosts. Good church, first of all. Go and get real ghost stories, not the fake ones. Beautiful ones. Okay, a nice, beautiful ghost story. You're wonderful. Can animals be reborn as ghosts? Of course they can. There's a woman, I think her husband died a long time ago, and just had one dog in her house. You know how tight she gets in the pets? And one day she was going for a walk in the forest with the dog, playing with it, jumping up and down, enjoying the company. And when she got back, she realized that she'd lost her finger ring. And it wasn't expensive, but it was like emotionally had a lot of attachments to that finger ring. So the two of them went back into the forest and tried looking roughly where they thought they must have lost it. You know, trying to look for a ring in the forest. Impossible. But they tried anyway. The next couple of days, she comes to our Centre Nona in Perth. And the next couple of days, the dog got ill and died. So she forgot all about her finger ring. There was the grief of losing someone so close to her, her dog. But after burying the dog, she swore to me, she said, "Look, I heard that dog barking in my house. I'm not imagining it, it's my dog, I know the sound of my dog's voice." But she was never in the same room when her dog barked. So she'd always run to that room, open the door, no dog there. And that happened for about 2 or 3 days. And then once she was at the front door of her house, and she heard the dog barking just on the other side of the door. Now only a couple of inches away, but the door was between them. So she really thought, "Now I can see that my dog again." She opened the door quickly. There's no dog there. But in the middle of the welcome mat was her finger ring. Her dog had found her finger ring for her, and that's the last time she heard of her dog. Beautiful little story. Ghosts are really beautiful, good, wonderful people. Beings. Just another wonderful little story. There was these two people in one of the old people's homes over in Perth. And there's this old man who lost his wife a long time ago. This lady who lost her husband. So they just, you know, bonded together. And not never to get married, but, you know, just be friends together. And she would cook meals for him. And he would, you know, just do little other chores for her in their rooms and the old folks' home. And they became very close friends. And they would talk, and, you know, he did tell her that he had a sister back in England somewhere. That's the only family he had. So when he suddenly died, the people in the old folks' home, you know, just wanted to find out, you know, family. They had no record of any sister in England. And she said, "Well, he told me he had one here, but they couldn't find any records." So she felt a bit guilty. She never asked the name of the sister or how to contact her. And so one night she fell asleep. In the middle of the night, she felt, she woke up, someone was stroking her cheek. And she woke up terrified, thinking someone had got into her room and was going to rape her or something. But turned on the light, there was no one in the room. The door was locked, the window was shut, and she had a piece of tissue for use at night time folded on the bedside table. She watched it rise up into the air and fall on the ground. There was no draft, no source of wind. She picked up that piece of paper and it had some numbers on it. It was a telephone number of the sister of this fellow who had died.
He'd written it down for her. So, no, this is our leader. So that she could tell. There's another fellow, Peter Sale, I don't mind saying it, because he's in Tasmania now. His family was from Essex, migrated over to Perth, and Western family were over here. And he said he woke up in the middle of the night. And he lived at home, just by himself in his house, not far from our centre. And he turned on the light, and it was his mother standing at the end of the bed. Now this Peter Sale, he is just the last person to ever expect, you know, to sort of, you know, be into weird stuff. He was really a down-to-earth person. And so he saw how his mum was supposed to be in Essex. He realised it was not a ghost. So he realised it was a ghost. Because his mum wasn't anywhere near Australia. But he was in his bed, looking at his mum, standing up, smiling at him. So the most beautiful feeling he had, not fear, but seeing his mother for one last time, expressing her love for her son, smiling. And he felt so much joy and happiness, even though he knew his mother must have died. And it wasn't a flash, it was about 3 or 4 minutes, he said. His mother standing there, clear, not some shadow trying to interpret, just as if, you know, that she was really there, just like I'm watching you, or you're watching me. Clear, smiling, no words were necessary. No thoughts, just bathing in his mother's love. And after 3 or 4 minutes, she just faded away, disappeared. And he wasn't crying. He felt what an amazing experience that was, and how lucky he was to see his mother for one last time. Being English, he turned on the electric kettle and made himself a cup of tea. That's all the English do, in that situation. And he was drinking his tea from the telephone line. It's in the middle of the night, sister in England, Pete, across the bad news with me on mum's side. How the heck do you know that? We've just come back from the hospital, just now. How do you know? And he told the story, his mother had been to visit him. So beautiful can that be? So ghost stories are just gorgeous, real ones. They're not scary at all. It just completes an unfinished business. Show when somebody has died, they still love you, care for you. And they still want to just make sure you're okay. One of my Sri Lankan disciples, her sister was getting really, really sick with a cancer. And I don't know why she did this, but she took her to Singapore to try, you know, really get the best doctors, try and make, there's plenty of good doctors in Sri Lanka, trying to make sure that she was going to be okay, give her the very best. But unfortunately, they couldn't do anything, so her sister, who was a follower of mine, gave me a call and said, can you please speak to my sister, she's dying. So I just, and she said, look, she's not going to be able to say very much because, you know, she's paralysed from the neck down and she's dying. So for 3 nights in a row, I talked to her sister from the phone in Australia to Singapore, trying to give her some help in the dying process. And the fourth night, never got any call, realised that she must have died. The fifth night, her sister called and said, my sister died, you know, just the night before. So, yeah, I thought that, that's why I didn't call. But I have to tell you this, that 6 or 7 hours after she died, she sent us an email from her account saying, that she was okay, and especially please thank Ajahn Brahm for his advice. So that's why I had to give you a call now and tell you. She had been paralyzed for many days before. There's no way she could send any emails. After death, 6 hours, she sent that email. Being a man, not really conversing with technology, I always wondered what Gmail meant. Ghost mail. That's beautiful. Okay, a couple of stories then. You say to reduce will, to get rid of it. The problem I have is that some people have lived their life with little will as they have been oppressed. Now that's just not what we mean. It's actually just the learning of meditation to relax. So you have an opportunity to let go of your will. You can't will yourself to let go of the will. That's a small will. That's not how you're going to get it. You get so still, so peaceful. The will, the choice, is not interrupting you. And then after a while, you get really deeply into this. And so, in the jhanas, especially the second jhana, there's no will around at all. There's no button to press to move. You can't come out of that state to will. It's just where the energy of that state just wears out, then you emerge afterwards. You're sort of stuck in there, but very pleasantly, blissed out. Wonderful state. That's one of the signs of the second jhana. It's still, perfectly still, because there's nothing to move it. This thing called will is gone. And the thing is, it's not your will. We always interpret the will as being one of our essential possessions. This is why it freaks you out afterwards. You know, at some point you've already been saying that things have gone missing, or you just when you're walking, meditating, the floor disappears. Freaky stuff is quite safe. And sometimes I mentioned you're walking, meditation, I'm not doing the walking. It's just automatic. Things which you always believe you cause, you will, you make happen, they happen by themselves. You don't need to do anything. Those weird experiences challenge the way you perceive the world. But more about that another time. Look, quite a few. If all physical illnesses can be cured by meditation, how is it that the Buddha had dysentery? Ajahn Chah had a stroke, Venom Casey Demonam had cancer. It's not all physical illnesses can be cured by meditation. So there's some physical illnesses. Meditation can alleviate symptoms. And every now and again, it can actually do some amazing cures. But not everyone can be cured. Because everyone has to die sooner or later. So the meditation, just letting go, can create a huge amount of physical health and well-being, not demanding things from others, but medication. So it's not the case of all, but some can. We all know that stress-related illnesses are just huge. And at the very least, we know how stress can cause many illnesses. It was the comedian George Burns, I think on his 96th birthday, you know, he used to go out in the evening to nightclubs, he's 96, drinking whiskey, smoking big cigars, and eating hamburgers. And he was interviewed and said, but you eat greasy food, smoke cigarettes or rather big cigars, drink whiskey, stay up the whole hours of the night. At your age, aren't you concerned about your lifestyle? Aren't you worried about your health? And he replied, my wife was worried about my health. That's why she died 20 years ago. The worry, or is it the stuff you put in your mouth, or the stuff you put in your mind? Do Buddhas class humans as high beings and other beings? If so, why? Oh, just they class Buddhists or human beings as, you know, a place where you have suffering and happiness. Enough suffering to keep you on your toes, realizing that you can't really be that lax, because you don't know what's going to happen next. But enough happiness and comfort, then you have some time and freedom to actually concentrate and meditate and ask the questions of why. So, they call it a very fortunate life, that you are a human being. But you do the rounds. Humans, animals, ghosts, devas, all sorts of different beings. So, it depends. Where are you going to go next? Isn't that what, not Google, where do you want to go today? What's that?
Google Maps.
Well, not Google Maps, it's something else. Anyway, so where do you want to go next in life? Where do you want to explore next in your journey through samsara? Do you want to be a ghost? The person is scared of ghosts. Do you want to have your next life as a ghost? Really interesting. Then you can come and scare me. Okay, so I think that's enough questions now, it's 9:30. Okay, there's still a few to ask, but more than a few. I think I've got to about half of them. And what's done is finished. Don't have to finish it, you know. Okay. Stop!